As inflation subsides, markets are up, but the latest Global Financial Stability Report warns about getting too comfortable, especially when it comes to debt.
Yes, it will certainly help. But even if inflation comes down and policy interest rates were to come down as well, what really matters to government's funding are longer-term interest rates.
Picking up on Jason's point about debt, there's also a private side of this, right? So the broader non-sovereign part. And we just had a chapter in the GFSR that focused on what we call private credit. That market has reached globally more than $2 trillion, 2.1.
Wow.
Of which about three-quarters of that is in the U.S. My name is Fabio Nadolucci. I'm a deputy director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF. I'm responsible for the Global Financial Stability Report and Global Financial Markets Monitoring.
Hello, I'm Jason Wu. I'm an assistant director in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF, and I oversee the Global Markets Division.
Financial Fragilities Along the Last Mile of Disinflation is the title of the latest GFSR, which helps policymakers spot the potential bumps in the road.
So things have settled down a little bit since we spoke last in the fall. What has changed in the past 6 months to relieve some of the recessionary risks?
I think the main change is that the global economy appears increasingly likely to achieve what we call the soft landing, so to avoid the recession, and financial stability concern appears to be receding. So by our measure of financial stability risk, those risks have actually declined. This expectation of a global disinflation is entering what we call the last mile, and so monetary policy will be able to ease, and that expectation of an ease of monetary policy, not just in the US, but in other countries as well, and the emerging market has already started in previous quarters, is supporting and pushing up risk asset price worldwide. Not only that, but we have seen, which has been historically unusual, that emerging markets have been quite resilient. Not only that, but with the improving risk sentiment, even frontier economies have been able to take advantage of this buoyancy in financial markets to issue international debt. And that's what we call your financial condition easing, essentially is an increase in asset prices, in equity markets, compression of credit spreads, low volatility. So some sort of aggregation of all these financial variables, that's what we call financial condition. That easing is typically not the case when central banks increase interest rates. Now, that said, in the last few months, we have seen some concerning sign that this inflation momentum may be slowing, at least in some countries. Mm-hmm. And that raised the question of whether central bank may be able or not to deliver those interest rate cuts this year that markets are expecting.
And on that note, as much as people would like to put this high inflation era behind them, inflation is still with us, as the latest numbers from the U.S. for March indicate. And the report does warn that there could be an abrupt turn in the financial markets. What might trigger that?
So as I mentioned, the financial condition have eased contrary to historical experience, if you want, right? So I think one of the risks we see is that this ease of financial condition will actually support aggregate demand even more. And so if you think that there is a need for central bank to slow down, at least in some countries like the US, to slow down aggregate demand, to bring inflation down back to target, that easing on financial condition may, in some sense, make the central bank job more difficult. A risk that we highlight is that because of financial condition easing, so lower rates, higher equity prices, higher home prices, mm-hmm. people might borrow more, right? They could borrow more as firms because the borrowing rates or spreads have compressed, or household borrowing against the value of their own house. Home equity. And as again, you mentioned the case of the latest number in the US, yeah. The CPI for March. We also see an increase in commodity prices. That would be another factor because of geopolitical factors, the conflict in the Middle East. That would be another factor for headline inflation. That would make central banks a little bit more skittish, I think, about easing monetary policy, right? So it's the combination of compressed volatility that we see across markets, perhaps with the exception of interest rates. Optimistic expectation for earnings, they are boosting equity prices. Like look at the Magnificent Seven, for example. Mm-hmm. That's been the story and the headlines for a while. compression of spreading credits and everything else seems to be going up effectively, right? You see cryptos going up and even gold starting to increase quite a bit. So that's the risk, that if there is a reversal of this asset price increase, that reversal, because central banks may not deliver, that might be in some sense a shock to markets.
So we can't get too comfortable.
Never get too comfortable.
So another thing that jumped out at me in terms of things that we need to still be worrying about is how the report says that, and I'm quoting here, the cracks in the financial system have not ruptured any further. Jason, maybe remind us what those cracks are, given how ominous that sounds and how they play into the risks going forward.
Yes, I'll start with the one that most of us would remember, which is that about a year ago, several pretty large banks went under around the world.
Yeah.
Mismanagement of risks was probably the main reason, but high interest rates might have been the trigger to some of these failures, and hence, in a sense, high interest rates opened up these cracks. There are some other smaller cracks, including the fact that some companies have started to default as interest rates increase. And real estate markets are now being weighed down by higher financing costs as well. But overall, as stated in the report, the cracks have not ruptured further. Despite some weak banks still present, overall, the banking system is fairly sound. And thanks to post-crisis regulatory reforms, households and corporates were in decent financial shape after the pandemic has ended, unlike was the case during the financial crisis of 2008, when they were riddled with debt. So for these reasons, I think the cracks have been pretty obvious. However, they have not ruptured further.
Okay, so you just mentioned their banks. And in the past, a couple of GFSR's banks were seen as a pretty significant risk. This report says banks have shown considerable resilience, but that the problem has not gone away. What are the banks that you worry about most these days?
Yeah, so taking a step back, I think the overall banking sector is quite resilient. Mm-hmm. However, there are a tail of banks that we are monitoring or concerned about. So not surprisingly, banks with more asset quality issues, where they hold poorer assets that are now being pressured by higher interest rates, banks with low capital to buffer against these losses, and large holdings in sectors that are struggling, like commercial real estate, banks with less stable deposits and funding, these are the banks that are on our monitoring list. And just a little bit nerdy and touching upon the methodology, we construct this list using analyst forecasts along these various dimensions. And so there's a forward-looking element to it. We do this to around 400 banks around the world, and the report documents that a small subset of these banks are, you know, demonstrating concerns along several of these dimensions. But again, to be clear, we're not saying that these banks are on the brink, but more that they are the ones that have existing problems, which might be exacerbated by the asset repricing scenario that Fabio has talked about. For example, if there is going to be upside inflation surprises that will, you know, lower asset prices, raise interest rates further, some of these dimensions will make these banks more vulnerable.
And what you say a small number, what kind of number? Like, what are we looking at here?
So out of the 400 banks, I think 1/8 or so are, you know, in this type of situation. But I would also take this opportunity to mention that there are obviously more than 400 banks in the world. Yes. These are the ones for which we can get the forward-looking data on. So the sample may or may not be representative.
Okay. So emerging markets have been under intense pressure for several years now. And the report says that emerging markets have also been quite resilient, but they're also still facing high financing costs. So I guess the question is, why are emerging markets facing high financing costs? And what is the risk there to the broader financial system?
Right. So let me first touch upon the resilience piece. The resilience probably speaks to the improvements in emerging markets policy frameworks. For example, central banks have become more credible. They have controlled inflation better. And so that has improved confidence for foreign investors, for example, to invest in these emerging market economies, or at least reduce the chance that investors will abruptly flee. But the resilience, as you pointed out, doesn't mean that they won't be tested again, okay. Right? So as long as global interest rates are high, they will likely continue to be tested. And so let's think about a couple of examples. For emerging markets that borrow in US dollars, euro, or other reserve currencies, their financing costs are intimately tied to global interest rates. But for even for emerging markets that borrow in their own currencies, in other words, they issue domestic instruments, they might still face external pressures because when global interest rates are high, the opportunity costs, right, for investors to purchase these emerging market assets is high also, pushing up overall financing costs. And on the point about risk to the broader financial system, emerging markets are the growth engine of the world. So if they get into trouble, there certainly might be systemic implications.
Mm. Yeah, and sticking with emerging markets for a second, the report looks at struggling real estate markets, especially in China, but also the office or commercial property sector in the U.S. What are the risks there, do you think?
Well, let me start with the latter. Mm-hmm. For the following reason, that we start paying, obviously, we've been following, tracking this market for a while, but the flare-up of vulnerabilities in the U.S. banking sector, particularly in the regional banks, yeah. That forces up, there was a incentive to pay more closer attention to commercial real estate because that's a big share of what regional banks do together with some middle market corporate loans. So one thing that is unique of this tightening cycle is that we looked back over the last 30, 40 years, how do commercial real estate prices behave during periods of tightening of monetary policy? And going back as much allows you to include periods when inflation was higher than what we got used after the financial crisis, right? So if you look at where we are now in terms of commercial real estate price developments, they have declined more than 10% since the beginning of the Fed tightening in 2022. Mm-hmm. The extent of decline, we've never seen something like that, essentially. So traditionally, wow. In the past, during tightening, either commercial real estate have been either flat, if you want, or actually rising. Even the latest, so going back to 2015, for example, they ended up rising somewhat. Now, it's a function, obviously, whether recession followed or not. But we have never seen, again, over these multiple decades, such adjustment in commercial real estate price. One of the reasons is because there are probably structural changes in some segments, like the offices is one good example. And so we do see some deterioration in credit quality. And that is true in what we call the securitization market or the CMBS. Those are loans backed by commercial real estate, financed by non-bank investors, non-bank lenders, so institutional investors. We also see a deterioration in the broader banking sector as well. And we see some pickup in default rates. Mm. Why banking, right? So it's not just the U.S., though. This is a more global phenomenon. We have seen that in some jurisdictions, it's a very high, north of 25% of commercial real estate as a share of loans. At a time when banks are starting to tighten also their lending standards, as you would expect at times of tighter monetary policy, particularly in the U.S., to go back to the U.S., we try to map out the credit quality performance by bank size. So we look at smaller bank, medium size, and larger banks, and we see a pickup in non-performing loans that's particularly large for larger banks. Yeah. I think one explanation, for example, is in the office segment. The larger banks tends to lend against office collateral in cities, while smaller bank is outside of the city. And so the decline in the value of offices in larger cities is larger. And so you see decline in capital. That's on the commercial real estate. Now, the real estate is a problem, as you mentioned, also in China. Mm-hmm. A comparison that it's often made is how is the development in China compared to Japan, say, like decades ago, or the U.S. subprime market. If you look at prices, I think you see that decline are coming down in real estate, residential real estate in China, not as different than I think what we have seen in previous episodes. Where there is a stark difference is in activities. The activity that resembles much more the U.S. real estate crisis, residential real estate, than the Japanese one. It's the segment of the property developers, essentially, that is the crisis. There they have continued to have access to some form of financing because mortgage borrowers tend to prepay some of the sales in China. But what has dried up is access to banks and capital markets.
So is there a glut in the housing industry?
Yes. So there is that, and there's also now the issue that confidence doesn't seem to have bottoming out, right? That's the core of the problem. Mm. If you want to fix this, in some sense, you need to fix the confidence problem. You pull the floor on the move in house prices, and eventually you start getting some rebound. The risk is a contagion, right? Because, for example, housing or land sales, it's also a source of financing for local government. And so this is the channel of contagion that we have highlighted in the past that we are concerned of.
Okay. So the report also looks pretty closely at debt, both public and private, as a potential risk to future growth. But as we see inflation subsiding somewhat and the expectation that interest rates will slowly come down, isn't that good news for debt in terms of reducing the debt burden?
I'll start with the government debt mm-hmm. Angle. Yes, it will certainly help. But even if inflation comes down and policy interest rates were to come down as well, what really matters to government's funding are longer-term interest rates. And so this report shows that there is evidence that investors are forecasting higher longer-term interest rates for many governments, including in emerging markets going forward. So why might that be? I think one of the reasons is that there is concerns about fiscal discipline in some of these countries. And so there's the expectation that they will need to borrow more, and that, generally speaking, pushes up interest rates. So fiscal discipline is therefore needed. If these governments cannot do that, debt grows, and economic growth don't necessarily keep pace with the debt growth and the interest rate levels. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we might be faced with a debt begets debt type of scenario in some emerging markets.
Okay, so debt begets debt. What is the thinking behind that?
So when debt levels are high, the interest rates charged on such debt is high. Economic growth doesn't catch up with the interest rates. In other words, growth is below the interest rate level. Mm-hmm. This means tax revenue for governments is going to be less than the interest payments demanded on the pile of debt. And so the only solution is to borrow more.
I see.
Hence, debt begets debt.
So the concern about debt, is it about the current debt levels or is it about the potentially larger debt levels down the road?
That's a very important question. So the Fiscal Monitor, which is published also as one of the IMF's flagship, will point out that it is both the problem with the debt pile today as well as the projected fiscal deficits, which creates more debt in the future. So it is a bit of both.
I see.
Picking up on Jason's point about debt, there's also a private side of this, right? So the broader non-sovereign part. And we just had a chapter in the GFSR that focused on what we call private credit. Mm-hmm. So think of this as loans extended by non-bank lenders. So in this case, alternative funds, investment funds, so private credit funds, another structure, to corporations that they are what we call middle market, so they are smaller, right? They are much smaller than what they usually have access to, either public markets or the high-yield bond market, for example, or the what is called the broadly syndicated loan market, right? This is a group of banks that get together and provide loans to these firms.
Yeah.
This is a segment of much smaller firms. And so that increase, that market has reached globally more than $2 trillion, 2.1,
wow.
Of which about three-quarters of that is in the U.S., That includes both actual loans as well as like what we call dry powder, which is available capital. But it's a very large number. It has grown very rapidly over the last few years. It's part of a broader trend from public to private markets. We have seen in equities before, and now we're starting to see in credit. Some of the reasons are structural, like, again, this structural move from public to private. Some of it is conjunctural, like post-financial crisis rates were very low, so institutional investors starting to look for yield in other places. Part was also related to, the most strict regulatory and supervisory posture of the authorities that made bank lending, particularly to smaller borrowers, more expensive from a capital perspective for banks. I think there are benefits to this. So just to a few, one, that the returns on this illiquid investment, it's higher, generally speaking, for investors. So that's been attractive for the investors. It's also attractive for borrowers because, again, often they don't have access to either public markets or they prefer to deal with one lender or a few number of lenders. There's more flexibility, more personalized relationship.
Hmm.
also good from a financial stability perspective, because I think a diversification of funding in general makes the system more resilient. Now, that said, those are the benefits. The report also tried to look at vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And so we look at a number of vulnerabilities, some of them being the characteristic of the borrowers, comparing them to public markets and bank loans. And they tend to be smaller, they use more leverage. There are usually not what we call liquidity mismatches, meaning that the maturity of the investment of these funds matches how long the capital is locked in by the investor. So there's no run risk, right? What you would see in a bank. Although there is a smaller share of this segment now that is being marketed to retailers. So when you talk to retailers, then I think the bar or the concern are higher, even though there are some liquidity management tools. We look at leverage. Leverage is always a concern, and we found that there are layers of leverage at the borrower level, in the fund structure itself, they borrow from banks, collateralized, and then investors themselves can use leverage. So these layers of leverage for which we have very little visibility. I think that's right. One of the concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last point, that this is a very interconnected sector, includes institutional investors like pension insurance, include banks, include private credit funds. So this lack of visibility, very interconnected, and there's a cross-border aspect. Some of these funds are U.S. funds that invest in Europe. So not being able to track and monitor closely and having to rely on anecdotes, on outreach to investors, or partial data, that lack of transparency and valuation. Valuation are often lagged, so they don't adjust very quickly.
Right.
That combination of factors, I think, yes, it's not a financial stability risk, an imminent financial stability risk, I think.
Or at least not that you know of right now.
That I know of. But it could be an amplifier. If there's a shock, this sector could, in fact, if they all pull back at the same time as bank pull back, it could amplify the initial shock and make the recession more prolonged.
And finally, cybersecurity, which is a growing concern at many levels. What would it take to make the financial system better prepared to protect itself from cyber attacks, which seem to be all too common these days?
So let me make a couple of points first, because we got a bunch of questions on, like, you guys, the first time that you go into cyber, just to clarify, the fund, the IMF has done work on cyber way before. You can find in the financial sector assessment program, so the bilateral assessment, the financial sector. We have done technical assistance, workshop, capacity development.
You've been tracking the evolution of cyber.
And we have been engaged at the international level with the Basel Committee, OIOSCO, the Financial Stability Board. What is new here is that we try to assess risk from a global financial stability risk. That's, I think, the new angle that we come to this. Another reason, I think, was that there's been a significant increase in cyber incidents. So particularly starting for post-COVID 2020, just to give you an idea, in the financial sector, over the last 20 years, there have been 20,000 incidents with a cumulative losses of $12 billion. So those are not, they're not small number. So clearly, there's an increase in this risk. So what we want to do, we try to figure out what are the characteristics that make, obviously, this is focused on for the financial sector, right, the report.
Yeah.
So what is that makes the financial sector unique in some sense? I think there are three characteristics. One is the market concentration, particularly when you think of critical services like payments, for example, right? Or custody banking or financial market infrastructure. There's a lot of concentration of assets. So concentration per se, it's a vulnerability. The second point, that a lot of these banks use the same IT service providers.
Yeah.
There are benefits, there are efficiencies, but if something happens there, that becomes a common source of stress. And then there is interconnectedness, generally speaking, between technological and financial institutions. So this is why it's so important that the homework is done both at the level of the financial institution itself. So they need to develop, test, response, and recovery procedure. There is a crisis management framework in place at the national level, as well as response protocols. What we have done a survey of about 75 countries looking into emerging markets. We are trying to compare the weaknesses in the advanced economies at the firm level vis-a-vis emerging markets. Now, advanced economies, firms are more exposed. I think one simple explanation is that they have a larger digital presence. But cyber attacks also happen in emerging markets, particularly in the financial sector. And so what we have found in the survey is that although emerging markets have been improving, so somehow closing the gap, there is still a gap. And this gap, it's important that it's been closed, although these countries often, they don't have resources, they don't have the technology in place to do. That's why it's not just monitoring, but where the technical assistance, the capacity development become important. And so to close, I think what the fund can do to help is, one is this financial sector assessment programs. Those only are geared toward the larger countries, but even for the smaller one, we can do technical assistance, capacity development. We also develop a cyber risk supervision toolkit that has model regulation, risk assessment tools, supervisory process document. Helping the low-income countries to get to a point where there are resources, there is awareness, but also the technology in place.
And for people who want to learn more about the cybersecurity risks in the GFSR report, there's a whole chapter dedicated to that specifically.
Yes.
Fabio Natalucci and Jason Wu head the Global Financial Stability Report team. Thanks to you both.
Thank you
very much.
Fabio Natalucci and Jason Wu are both in the IMF Capital Markets Department and head the Global Financial Stability Report. Check it out at imf.org/GFSR. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.